On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WBR Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and we have another exciting and fun show program planned for you today. We have with us Tom Adolph from Houston, Texas. Tom is an attorney, and Tom and his family have put together probably what, in my opinion, is the most effective and significant website available out there, because they actually tracked and have collated all of the foreclosures in Houston, and they've put it on a website. And it's available for all of you guys out there, and I would highly recommend that you take a close look at it. The website is hoadata.org. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be back, Sue.
It's nice having you. I know we've been trying to get you on for a while, and you're a very busy man, but I thank you for taking time out.
You're welcome.
One of the things that you've done, and the reason what we're going to be talking about mostly today, is a paper that you wrote about how to take over your homeowners association. And want to tell us a little bit about that and why you wrote it?
Yes. It's a paper that appears on our website called Reclaiming Your HOA. And if your listeners want to see it, if they go to the HOA data website, they can go to the papers section. And then I think it's the first paper that appears there. And the reason that I wrote it was really out of frustration with the situation. Since we began our collection of data and the website, I have gotten involved at least twice in efforts in our Texas legislature to bring reform to the legal situation. I have also offered many times to help people for free, you know, what lawyers call pro bono, and every single time, 100% of the time, the client went away for one reason or another, or just didn't come through with things that I needed, and I became and am frustrated with and a bit pessimistic about any chance of getting things done through the legislature and getting things done through the courts, because the law is fairly stacked against the homeowners. And I think the most effective use of my own time and the most effective use of an owner who is facing abuse of his or her own time is to simply try to retake their HOA and to have their HOA act in a responsible and caring manner.
So you're not all that optimistic about anything happening in the legislative arena. Is that what you're saying?
No, I am not.
Why is that, Tom?
Very simply, I'd boil it down to a few issues. One is all the money is on the other side. And there's no strong organization, frankly, there's no organization on the reform side. We are facing attorneys and management companies who make, I'm fairly certain, many millions of dollars off of the current legal situation, And they are going to fight, and they do fight very hard to keep it the way it is. In Texas, there has been a change in the law every session since 1983, except for the 1993 session. And every single one of those changes took away rights of the homeowners and gave more power to the management companies and the lawyers and the HOA boards. And even a very recent change in Texas law was promoted as bringing reform, and in fact was entitled somehow the Winona Blevins Reform Bill, something like that. Yeah. I assume your listeners are somewhat familiar with the Winona Blevins case, and if not, I could go into it briefly. But it was styled and promoted as a reform, but in fact it wasn't, and it gave more power to the management companies and the attorneys and the boards. It is stacked against us. We don't have the organization. We don't have the money.
Would you go into the Winona Blevins? I mean, I know I covered it a number of times, and I had Marion Rosen on, and I even interviewed Winona Blevins herself. But we've got so many new people who are tuning in now, new listeners, and I'm not sure that they really understand or know what about the Winona Blevins situation.
Okay, Winona Blevins is a widow in the Houston area who several years ago was evicted from her home. I don't remember exactly the value of the home, but I think it was over $200,000, fully paid for many, many years, and was evicted because of failure to pay assessments to her homeowners board. She is an elderly woman. I think she's still alive. She did not receive notice of the assessments due or of the case against her because late at night she would not answer the door, and that's when people tried to serve her. And so suddenly she found herself evicted from her home. It became a big uproar in the Houston area, more of a tempest in a teapot, unfortunately, in that very little was done. She, through a lot of efforts of a lot of people, she was finally brought back to her home. But I think most of her furniture was destroyed by the people who evicted her. I mean, I don't think it was done in a mean-spirited way, but just as they evicted her and stored her belongings, a lot of it was broken. And it was a very sad situation. And as you mentioned, you had Marion Rosen on. She was the attorney for Winona Blevins and helped her eventually to get back into her house.
Yeah, the that case was, in fact, got a lot of national publicity as well. I know 2020 featured Winona Blevins in one of their episodes. And but the whole idea, Tom, was that they managed to send her. And I think one thing that never is brought out is the association managed to send her a letter letting her know that she was, in fact, in arrears, which she was, and she'd been sick. And the fact that she took a check to the association office for the entire amount she was billed, and the association refused to cash it, and then went ahead and foreclosed. But when they sent her the notices for foreclosure, all of a sudden, they had the wrong name. And her husband had never lived there. So, is that accidental or is it by design? What happened there?
Well, I don't know the facts of that. I do know what you mentioned. I had heard that as well. But whether it's intentional or not, I can't comment.
I'm beginning to think that there has to be something intentional because we hear it over and over and over again. We hear that people are getting their bills and they're actually going and paying what's on the bill amount. And then when they get the notices of foreclosure, all of a sudden they're going to the wrong address, the wrong person. You know, it's just, it doesn't make any sense, Tom.
Well, I heard a similar one recently in an email I think my mother had forwarded to me. There's an effort going on right now in Houston, in the Houston area, that I hope is successful. A group in the subdivision called Sterling Green
mm-hmm.
are trying to take back their neighborhood. When we first came out with our website, Sterling Green was one of the top subdivisions in the Houston area with foreclosures. I think it was somewhere in the range of 10%.
Wow.
And a man in the Sterling Green area is leading the effort right now to try to kick out the present board and change the situation, and it's very inspiring to watch him and his efforts. But the email that I got, I think yesterday, noted that when they had a recent vote or meeting, the board or the management company, whoever it was that was deciding as each person would appear whether or not their vote, whether they could vote, did on some occasions just say that a person couldn't vote because they owed as little as under $2 on their assessments, and so they could not vote at that meeting. And the next day, this one in particular, the management company said, oh, that was a mistake, you could have voted.
Oh.
It was our mistake. So these mistakes that they make, you know, can serve to their advantage, and whether they are intentional or not, I don't know, but it highlights for me the problem of having the management company involved in elections or votes at all when there's, to me, a conflict of interest there, especially when you have a situation like you have in Sterling Green where the very subject of the meeting is whether or not the neighborhood wants the current situation with management companies and the attorneys to continue. You have the very people that many are trying to kick out determining who gets to vote and other things that affect that decision.
I think you raise a very good point because you're right. Management companies usually are the ones who are causing a lot of the problems, and when you get people who want to oust them, all of a sudden, it's the management company who decides whether or not they can vote and counts the ballots, and whoops, we lost a few here.
Yeah.
So that's why it's very difficult to take over. But you've written, what, about 25 pages, and you highlight step by step exactly what people need to do in order to take over. And you also start off with a caveat as to who really has a legitimate reason to want to take over their association. What?
Yes, because if you don't have a really serious issue, if you're just trying to take over because of some issue that the rest of your neighborhood will not care about, you're not going to be successful, and you will, at least it's very unlikely you'd be successful, and you're not going to get your neighbors interested in it.
So what would some of the issues be? What kind of things should people decide are serious enough in order to mount this campaign, because it's going to take a lot of work?
It is going to take a lot of work. I think just some examples of what would be a legitimate fundamental issue would be something like the situation that I just mentioned in Sterling Green, where there are foreclosure actions filed against maybe 10% of the owners, recognizing that the filing of a foreclosure action is really the tip of the iceberg, because not every situation gets to the filing of a foreclosure action, where what really amounts to a legal blackmail, where people are being squeezed for extra money, for fines, where situations like you mentioned with, oops, we lost your check, but because we lost your check, your payment is late, so you owe us a late fee. I think situations like that certainly qualify for one where people ought to be considering reclaiming their HOA. Others, there's a neighborhood here in Houston where one person has been the HOA president for the last 13 or 14 years. He no longer lives in the neighborhood, and it's just simply a money-making venture for him as he collects the assessments from folks. That, to me, is a place where they really need to reclaim their HOA. A situation where you have board members misappropriating funds, writing checks for themselves, entering into contracts with friends and neighbors, using the HOA as their own source of livelihood, that would be another situation. And I've heard of other situations where the HOA is maybe not in general used in this way, but where some board members carry out a vendetta against other neighbors. That would be a situation that I think where one should try to reclaim the HOA.
Let's go back to the foreclosures for just a minute. One of the issues that we've kind of dealt with, and that was mentioned in Texas, and I don't know if it ever made it through, it was a bill that said that no foreclosures would happen until and unless it was put to a vote of the neighborhood.
No, that did not go through.
That did not go through. So, okay, well, how would people know that all of these foreclosures are happening unless they're down in the courthouse watching these filings?
They won't. And that reform idea was actually one that I was pushing in the last legislative session. And I ran into some opposition from interesting people who are on my same side of the issue, who said, well, you know, there's a privacy issue. A lot of people don't want this known, that they have a problem with their HOA. I can see that difference of opinion, but I really believe that we need the light of day on these situations. We need people to know it. And I view foreclosure as the nuclear weapon in the arsenal of an HOA. And while I really would like to not have a foreclosure power, I think that that if there is going to be a foreclosure power, it should only be exercised by a vote of the owners. That's my view. It hasn't gone anywhere with our legislature.
I like that view because we're told the associations, the reason you want associations and one of the benefits of an association is that people are more in control of what happens in their own neighborhood. But how can they be in control when they haven't got a clue as to what's going on in their neighborhood?
I agree.
And so, you know, if somebody is not paying either because they're being stubborn, and I don't think that there are too many like that, or if there's someone who has a serious health problem, you know, if there is a problem, then maybe the neighbors ought to know about it. Maybe the neighbors will vote not to.
That's exactly the way I feel. One of the problems I have with the foreclosure practice right now is that when a neighbor is in trouble, when they're having illness or financial problems, that's the time when I would like the neighborhoods to come out and help them rather than kicking them out of the neighborhood or not even knowing, you know, being in ignorance of the fact that the HOA board is kicking them out.
You know, if somebody's having a serious problem, I mean, many of the neighbors may say, look, it's worth my kicking in a couple of extra bucks a month or whatever it is to help this neighbor.
Exactly, and the neighborhood should have the opportunity to make that decision.
And the only way they can do that is when they have the, you know, when they're in on what's going on.
Right.
But a lot of the things that you point out, I think, are excellent. But frankly, Tom, how do you know about it? How do you know
that an owner is being harassed or abused or having a vendetta carried out against them, or, you know, the thing is, the truth is, you don't know. You don't know if the board is using assessment dollars to pay their own bills.
Right. And, you know, I would assume that the people who are listening to your program probably 100% do not fall into this category because they're already interested in this. But if any of them are a subject of abuse right now, they ought to take some steps to make sure their neighbors know what's going on, because there's it just is too often that people just take it silently and you know, move on.
It's interesting. It's an interesting phenomenon because a lot of people are actually embarrassed at being at odds with their association. They think they've done something wrong, and they don't want to talk about it.
That is true. And, you know, in our the research that we did, as we counted the foreclosure actions in the Houston area, I came across one foreclosure action against a friend of mine. And realizing that he might be embarrassed about it, I have on several occasions talked about our website or talked about what we're doing, and I think we've had two or three conversations, and he has never mentioned that he had an action against himself.
Does he know that he had an action against himself? Is he aware of it?
Yes, he does.
Okay.
Yeah, I know that from the court papers.
Oh, okay. Because sometimes people don't know about it. I mean, Winona didn't, and she's not the only one.
Right.
You know, there's this... I don't know. They sent... All of a sudden, they lose your correct address. I mean, I've dealt with that here. And it just seems so universal that it's got to be, you know, it can't be accidental.
Well, and it's partly because there's no accountability. That the harm from the accident is to the owner and not to the management company or the board or the attorneys.
Yeah. Okay, so now they've determined that you have a problem in your association and you want to do something about it. So what do we tell them to do next?
Well, I think the first thing to do is to remember that in everything you do, the ultimate goal is to get the votes to elect a new board. You know, in any project that we humans do, we can go off on rabbit trails too often, and different parts of the different steps can become more important than they are to us, or than they should be. The ultimate goal in everything is going to be to get the votes to elect a new board. And to do that, you're going to have to run, in essence, a PR campaign. It is going to be public relations through and through. And the only way, I think, to get the votes, to get your neighbors interested in it, is to identify serious problems that the neighbors, each neighbor can say, oh, that's my problem, not just your problem. Because too often in these HOA fights, most of the neighbors look at it as, oh, that's somebody else's problem, it's not mine, it'll never happen to me.
Well, so many people are afraid of saying anything because they're afraid of being targeted next.
That's right.
You know, and that's the power, the abusive power of an association.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I don't say anything and they forget I'm there, then they'll leave me alone. So why should I stick my neck out for you? But that's a good point.
Yeah, and this fight that's going on right now is a very good example. It has been a surprise to me that when we came out with the, I don't remember how many years ago we first came out with our website, I've been surprised that Sterling Green and a few other neighborhoods that are way at the top have not acted collectively before this. Because, as I said, I think some of the figures were around 10%, but the liens filed, as opposed to lawsuits, the liens filed against some of these neighborhoods were up over 50%. And
50%
of the homes, each different homes, that means that there's by no definition can the HOA be representing the neighborhood if it is acting against more than 50% of the owners. But it's just so surprising that the neighborhoods have not reacted, and I really don't know the explanation for it. I can come up with guesses, but I don't know.
How much does an attorney make for filing a lien?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I really don't know. I know that in some of the cases, the awards of attorney's fees have been from $1,000 to $2,500 to $30,000. And some of the cases with bigger fights have had attorney's fees and other costs get up to a couple of $100,000, maybe more.
Wow.
It's going to depend.
And it depends on how expensive the house is, huh?
Yeah. And unfortunately, the HOA and the attorneys act throughout that entire proceeding with the knowledge that if they win, all of that cost gets put onto the owner. And the owner acts throughout that entire action with the knowledge that if the owner wins, the owner still has to pay his or her own attorney's fees, and the HOA will never bear that burden. At least in Texas, that's the way it is right now.
Oh, really? Because in Virginia, it's the winner is entitled to reasonable attorney fees, court costs and reasonable attorney fees.
Well, you have a better situation than we do.
Well, you know, we do when it comes to laws. I think Virginia's done fairly well. We've had some good legislators, and they haven't been willing, I guess, to sell out their constituents. So we do have some good open laws. We could do more. We could do better. We need to get rid of fines. We need to get rid of the power to foreclose. I don't think we need that. But we've been pretty lucky, I think, overall.
Yeah.
I want to remind you, we're talking to Tom Adolph, an attorney in Houston, Texas, who is responsible, in part, with his family, for collecting some of the most significant data around in the country nationally and putting it on a website called hoadata.org. If you haven't checked it out, do so. And there's also his paper that we're talking about today is on that website. Check it out as well. Okay, so we've investigated the problems. We've figured out whether other people are also affected by the problems. What's next?
Well, next is to enlist some help, because you really can't do this alone, and you really won't win alone, because it's got to appear that it's a neighborhood effort. So you've got to get other people to help you. And then you need to create some kind of a flyer and work on various means of communication to get the message out. And the flyer is one of the most difficult parts of this step. That might not be true. I think the most difficult is just continuing the fight throughout the long process, because it is a very long process. But the flyer, too often what I see from people has lots of emotional language in it.
Yeah.
And statements that are not factually correct.
Yes.
And you've got to remember, you're in a PR fight. Mm-hmm. The other side is going to fight hard, and they do. This Sterling Green fight that's going right now is hard. All of the fights throughout Houston that I know about are very hard fought, and that's because the management companies and the attorneys have a lot to lose if you win in reclaiming your neighborhood. So you've got to be very careful about the flyer and just make sure it states facts, and states facts quickly and briefly, in a way that will grab people's attention and let them come to the realization that it's a problem that they should be concerned about.
how I usually tell people to just put things in bullet form, because it's easier to read, and if you can just reduce the problem to one sentence, you're going to get the message across, and then let people contact you if they want to, you know, any more information on any one of the points that you raise.
Right, and the we got some really good information from people who have been through this fight, and one of them I never would have thought of had to do with the flyer, and that is, they said, don't stick it in mailboxes, don't tape it to
mm-hmm.
anything.
Yeah,
you can really get people angry.
Yes.
If you do that, you have to be very courteous and polite in how you do this.
That's right. Well, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll get some more tips on what to do, and we've got this step-by-step how to reclaim your homeowners association. We're talking to Tom Adolph from Houston, Texas, and we'll be back with him and lots more in a minute.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WBR Fairfax Radio, here on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. We're talking to Tom Adolph. But before we get back to Tom, I've got one quick announcement to make. I mean, we were talking offline here, and I was having a great time. But you will get the benefit of what we were talking about. A friend of mine lost her daughter 1 month before her 44th birthday to ovarian cancer. And there's going to be a walk to benefit ovarian cancer on June 12th in Reston. It's going to be at 10 a.m. and registration's at 8:30. There's a $25 registration fee. And all the money goes to the National Ovarian Cancer Coalition. And it's the disease that whispers, because by the time it's diagnosed, there's no signs or symptoms that there is a disease. By the time it's diagnosed, then it's usually too late. It's one of those diseases that can be cured if it's caught in time. So it's called the Whisper Walk for that reason, and the money will be used to let people know exactly what to listen for. So if you have a woman in your life, a female in your life that you consider worthy of a little time, please join us. It's going to be in Reston, and there's more information on the bulletin board here, so plan on joining us. And we're back with Tom Adolph. Tom, thank you so much. We were talking about how to take over your association, and while we were offline, you said that there was something else you wanted to mention that is not in the paper, and maybe before we get too far beyond this, maybe we ought to cover that? Or do you want to wait?
Actually, let me back up one. As you're writing that paper, the flyer, this is something we hadn't talked offline, but you want to get all the information you can. So get the records of your HOA, use the statutes that allow you to do that, talk to your neighbors about other problems, but really use the ability you have to go to court records or to request of your HOA certain records. But what Sue and I were talking about is a little, maybe a step beyond where we were, but I do want to say it, and that is, at least here in Texas, a mistake that a lot of people have made in trying to reclaim their HOAs is that once they do finally get a petition put together calling for a meeting to call for an election, they then assume that they have properly called the meeting and they have the meeting and conduct their business. Unfortunately, at least in Texas, and she was telling me that Virginia may be different, but at least in Texas, generally, the ability to call a meeting is only going to be in the bylaws and the articles, and those usually say that the members can call a meeting only by getting a petition together and presenting it to the board, and then the board is the entity that actually calls the meeting. The mistake people make often here is that once they get that petition and a certain percentage, they think that the meeting is called and they go forward with it without presenting it to the board and having the board formally call a meeting. That's a mistake I hope people start to avoid because it has been a problem in several efforts.
So basically, do your homework.
That's right.
Do your homework, know what you're doing, read the documents, understand what they say. If you don't understand what they say, get help, right, Tom?
That's right.
Maybe there's an attorney who lives in your association, believes in what you're doing, agrees with you, and is able to give you more of a legal understanding and recruit them, have them work with you. But do your homework so that all your work doesn't go down the drain. Because that's what happens, right?
That's right.
Okay, so
basically, you have to start over again.
You don't want to do that. And what's the next step?
Well, after the flyer, the next step is to try to collect the petitions, the signatures on the petition to call the meeting, which we were just talking about. And as you said, you've done your homework, and you get everything ready. And let's say you've gone through the steps now, you've gotten the votes, and you call the meeting. Then you've got to plan the meeting. And one thing that has worked well for several people in the Houston area is to get the League of Women Voters or some other organization that will help out with elections to come to the meeting and to help to run the meeting or make sure that it is run properly and the votes are done properly. Before you get to that meeting, you're going to have all your proxies in place. And that is another way that people make mistakes. You have to do the homework and find out exactly what's required of a proxy. One of the tricks that is being used right now to keep the current boards in place is to say that the proxies must be only on a form that they provide, and then they delay getting you the proxies. So that's one that you've got to watch out for. You also have to watch out for the many different tricks that are going to be used to disqualify people from voting. And I think we mentioned some of those before, but there's I don't know if there's a limit to the number of ways that can be created to disqualify somebody from voting.
That seems awfully unethical. Somehow, because you're going to have to live there and you're not getting a vote, a say in how the place is run. And it goes against everything we're told that associations are supposed to be.
Yes, it does.
How is it legal, Tom, to deny someone a voice?
Well, it's kind of like in a basketball game where I tell people, you know, it's legal until the referee says it's not legal. And, you know, until you have a mechanism where you can police this, which we really don't have in Texas right now, they're going to be able to continue to do it. Without answering directly, a similar thing we have here in Texas is that we have a right to request from our HOA inspection of their records. Well, that's a great right, but if people make the request and the HOA denies it,
yeah.
Who is there to police it? The only way to police it is to pay for a suit, to somehow file a suit, which is going to cost you. And then a lot of times the information you're seeking, there is a time limit. You want it, say, for a meeting that's coming up. Well, a suit's not going to help you because you won't get the records in time. So it's really a real-world problem as opposed to the legality of the situation.
I think one thing also that needs to be mentioned is that many bylaws will tell you how soon the proxies have got to be mailed out. And I think usually there's like 30 days before the election or whatever. Make sure you have it 30 days before the election and raise it as an issue at the annual meeting that, hey, the proxies were not sent in a timely manner.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of things that are often covered in bylaws that you have to be aware of. All the rules about the proxies, the form, when they go out, how soon they must have been signed before the meeting, because you can have stale proxies, whether the proxy has to be presented to an officer, because in some HOAs you can't walk in with the proxy. You have to have filed it beforehand. Whether what the rules are on the agenda, the rules on who is qualified to vote, there's a lot of homework to be done.
Yeah, it goes back to do your homework, know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then what?
Then hopefully you have your vote.
I bet you need a slate of candidates.
Well, yes. I guess we skipped that. That was way back there.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to. Yeah, well, you do need to identify people who are going to.
Unfortunately, that's one of the hardest problems.
You know, it doesn't take that many. It takes one board member. And, you know, you just have to be consistent. And when I got on, it was 8-1 votes. I mean, I was on my own. But if you're consistent and you keep communicating and you keep sticking to the issues, eventually people will start listening. Maybe not at first, but eventually people will start listening.
Well, Shu, it sounds like you've had a good experience. I know of some others who've had bad experiences in a similar situation. There's at least one woman here in Houston who got voted onto a board, and within a matter of months, the other board members kicked her off the board. And I know of other situations where, I got a call just this week from someone who has a board of three. And they had last year reclaimed their board, but one of that slate of three switched.
Yeah.
And is now on the side of the management companies and is causing them big problems. And so choosing that slate is a very difficult problem that you face.
Well, I think I think it's important not to get tangled up into personal fights and infights and name calling and all of that. Stick to the issues. Do your homework over and over and over again. Do your homework and be prepared to back up what you've got.
Yeah.
I mean, I did. I spent a lot of time, including a lot of time in court, going through and doing research on legal issues. And this was 20 years ago. I mean, we wrote the book on kicking out, on kicking out stale old boards. But I have to tell you, Tom, one of the things that there were two of us working together, basically. One of the things that we decided right up front at the very beginning was that no matter what happened, we were going to have fun. And 18 years later, we're still having fun, although I'm not on the board. Frank is, but we're still having fun with it.
Well, that's a great way to handle it.
And the thing is, you know, the boards don't have a sense of humor, so just, you know, they can't laugh at themselves, so we do that for them. So, you know, it can be done. It's just that you almost have to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
And you have to just keep on top of it and constantly do your homework, constantly keep updated on what's going on, constantly know what bills are being presented. And so, I mean, it's not... I don't know. To me, it's just a waste of time if having an association, because it's not the carefree living.
No, it's not, and it's the, what's the saying, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance.
Vigilance, yeah.
And I've thought about that a lot lately and just wondered, where is the eternal vigilance of the American people these days?
Yeah.
But as I, you know, as I kind of compare it to the American Revolution, there aren't a lot of comparisons for me, because there's a subtleness to the problem that exists today. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier about foreclosures and neighbors facing abuse without other neighbors knowing it. We have got to bring these abuses to the light. But even doing that, like the fight that we've had in the legislature recently, there's just a very powerful opposition, and it's going to be a very long fight.
You know, you're right, Tom. It is a powerful opposition. But you know what? There's more homeowners out there.
Yes.
And they've got the ultimate power, and they can use that power at the ballot box.
They have to first be convinced.
Yes.
That there's a problem, and that's their problem.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, when they start getting nipped in the behind in their pocketbook because of all kinds of problems, that's when people start paying attention. They've got to realize that this benefits the local government, not them personally. And once they understand that, I think maybe things will start turning around. But we only have one phone line, unfortunately, so what we do is we ask for emails if anybody has a question. And we got an email here from Stephen, and he says, a minority, not the minority in control, see there are issues, costly infrastructural maintenance and upkeep issues for the most part, that always seem to slip beneath the radar of the board and the majority of our fellow HOA members. The consensus seems to be, quote, look, it doesn't directly affect me right now. I can see it from my front window, and I may have moved on before there is a total collapse of, insert your own issues here. And besides, taking action now will only mean an increase in my HOA dues. Give me a break, go away, and quit wasting my time. The question is, how does one answer that response honestly and effectively? And I think what he's talking about is an inherent problem with associations, and that is that nobody wants to fund it.
Yes, no one wants to fund it. No one wants to spend the time. You had very kindly sent me that email before the show, so I'd thought about it. And his email question could be rewritten really to cover the problems that I was talking about earlier, that there's a minority of people in the neighborhood who see the foreclosure problem but are frustrated they can't get other people interested in it. There's a minority of people who see the harassment that's going on or some other problem. His situation, while it's a different problem, really faces the same problems that we have been discussing in trying to get the neighborhood to act on it, with perhaps one difference, and that is, if it is just something like a maintenance issue or something, maybe he could get a few neighborhoods to act, or the neighbors to act, without the HOA to take care of it. But if he doesn't want to do that, or if that's an impossible solution, then he really faces the same situation. You either present it to the board and try to convince them to act, or you're going to have to vote in a board that cares about it.
Well, I think so many associations are financially going belly up because, first of all, a lot of them did not have the knowledge and the understanding of what it took to fund for future repairs and maintenance. Again, the attitude is, why should I put my money into something that I'm not going to need or see the benefit of 10 years from now, because I plan on being gone in 5 years. So they don't want to fund for road repairs or street repairs or whatever it is. new people coming in, the new homeowners, don't necessarily want to pay for infrastructure that they didn't have, you know, they didn't get any use out of. And they don't want to be facing special assessments or decreased property values, because it's not going to be a cracked flower pot or, you know, a weed growing in the sidewalk, or the wrong shade of white in the window on your curtains that's going to devalue property. But if prospective homeowners, prospective buyers come in and their car gets swallowed up by a giant pothole, you know, that will devalue property. Nobody wants to have to deal with that to get home every night.
Sounds like the classic problem the governments face with how you fund street repairs and highways and everything else, and whether you do it with deficit spending or not.
Well, they just shut the problem over to the Homeowners Association and let it go.
That's what they have done.
And the Homeowners Association isn't doing anything with it, so... So I hope we answered your question, Stephen. I think that this is a legitimate property value issue here. If it's not being maintained, then you need to get it maintained. You need to get it seen to.
Yeah. Yes, and I think the bottom line is you either do it yourself, or you present it to your board, or you vote in a new board that will do it.
No, I think maybe if a few people get a number of flat tires from the potholes, maybe something will spur them on.
Yeah.
Tom, I was reading your paper, and one of the things that really surprised me was on page 9, you talk about abuses taking the power away from the owners. And, you know, A is creating new deed restrictions or similar rules without a vote by the owners. A very dangerous Texas law allows creation of new deed restrictions, bylaws, and rules without the consent of all owners, and even without any vote at all by the owners. What's going on?
Well, this is the problem that got my family interested in this issue from the beginning. It's a problem that has been forced on us by the legislature through the lobbying of the management companies and the attorneys. That is specific to the Houston-Harris County area, and I am hopeful that it's not anywhere else in the country right now, but we in Harris County face it, and that is that the HOA board has been given so much power under Property Code Chapter 204 that a neighborhood that has been existing for decades that does not even today have an HOA in Houston can, without the vote, let's just focus on one homeowner. That homeowner can not vote or vote against having an HOA, vote against having mandatory assessments, vote against having deed restrictions, and while he or she has lived in the house for decades without an HOA, can conceivably face a foreclosure for failure to abide by a deed restriction or a rule that he or she never agreed to, passed by a board that he or she never agreed to, that is the board of an HOA that he or she never agreed to. We're in a very bad situation.
But how can, I mean, they're taking away property rights that you already have.
Now, there you have a linguistic, semantic, legal issue that, unfortunately, is not as simple as you just stated it. The way the Texas Supreme Court ruled in the Inwood case a long time ago in the 80s, if when you bought the house, it said that you might be subject to an HOA, even though one debt doesn't exist today, and when you bought the house, the deed restrictions say you'll pay anything that the HOA assesses, then your property rights are subject to that obligation. Now, that's one situation, but the Chapter 204 created even a different situation, which is, as I described a few seconds ago, that you could be foreclosed for by an HOA you never even voted in. That situation has not been ruled on by the courts yet. I hope it never is, in that I hope no one has ever foreclosed in that situation. But it may have a good constitutional challenge. The other situation where you've agreed to the HOA and the assessments before you moved in, unfortunately, is outside the constitutional protection, according to the Texas Supreme Court.
Tom, thank you very much. We're out of time. I hope you'll come back. You've given us a lot of very, very valuable information here and incredibly valuable how-to. I appreciate you taking time out from your busy day to join us.
It was good talking to you, Sue.
Thank you so much. And be sure to tune in next week, because On the Commons will be back, same time, same place on all the dials and internet stations you can find. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions, and a very happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. See you all next week.